Okay, we've been learning Malachim Beis for a while, and we are nearing the end of Elisha. Now, when I say that we're nearing the end of Elisha, Elisha will continue to survive for a few more chapters. However, he doesn't really do much. The basic events of Elisha were a series of miracles that Elisha did over time. There are miracles of their bears that come, there's the widow, the oil, there's the Isha Shunamis, he revived the child, there is death in the pot, that Elisha kind of throws this stuff into the pot and it makes it heal. There's the story of Naaman, the floating axe, there's the fiery chariots, there's a siege in Shomron. These are the miracles of Elisha. And one thing we notice about Elisha is that he does tons of miracles, but these miracles, generally speaking, are focused on the individuals. Unlike Eliyahu, who's like the Rebbe, and he's like the firebrand, and he basically says, and it's not going to rain, and let everyone suffer, Elisha is a person who's connected to people, and who helps out individuals. That is the basic focus of Elisha. The last miracle of Elisha is the first four psukim here in Perek Ches. Okay? Now, this... Well, it's the first four psukim leading into the next nine psukim, I should say. But let's go back and we'll focus on these psukim carefully and we'll try to make something more of the Elisha episode. So Pasuk Aleph says that Elisha speaks to the woman, Asher Hechias Benahlimar, this woman that Elisha revived her child, and he says, go and live wherever you want because God said there's going to be a famine for 7 years. Now, the woman gets up, and she listens to Elisha, and she lives in Plishtim for 7 years. Technically speaking, you're not supposed to leave Eretz Yisrael, even when there's a famine, no? The psukim at the beginning of Megillas Rus speak about Elimelech, and it didn't work out too well, right? Elimelech picks up, he takes his family, and they leave, right? And basically everyone dies. So leaving Eretz Yisrael, even at times of famine, is not a good thing. But she leaves, and the Malbim over here comments, unfortunately, the way I put source sheets together, sometimes it's hard to find out. But if you go to the last two pages, right, it's page 1, 2, 3, 4, it's page 4, I give you a Malbim. So the Malbim writes, how can we tell this story of Elisha telling this woman to go and live somewhere else? So he writes, Yesh lomar b'derech hadrush, ki haya b'koach Elisha levat el gezerat ha-ra'av, rak al yedei shehechya es b'no v'lokach mafteach shal tchiya, lo haya yoko likach mafteach shal parnasa. Kemo shepirshu razav, shemitam zev eset tzorech, yoliyo lahachios, etc. Right? In other words, what Elisha is saying, or what the Malbim is saying, based on Gemara's at the beginning of Tainus, is once Elisha revived the child, so therefore Elisha now has the key for Tchiyas HaMesim. The Gemara says that human beings cannot have more than one of the three big keys. There's Tchiyas HaMesim, there is rain / Parnasa, which is the opposite of famine. And then the other key the Gemara speaks about is... I'm forgetting. But you can't have two of those three keys. Now, Elisha, because he has the key of Tchiyas HaMesim now, so therefore, he does not have the key for the famine, and he is forced to allow the famine to go on because he revived the child. Since he revived the child, so the famine has to go on. So therefore, Elisha says, you know what, there's a famine coming, and just leave. You can't stay because there's a famine. So she goes away for 7 years. Pasuk Gimel, she comes back at the end of 7 years, and she goes to scream to the king about the fact that her house and her field had been taken away. Apparently, while she was gone, someone came and took away her house and her field early.
Why would he send her away? Why wouldn't she just live in whatever shape that her son belonged to?
So apparently, things were really bad. I'll tell you how bad things were because of this famine. The Radak over here comments, It's the first radak, the bottom of page 4, going up to page 5. B'divrei Razal, otan sheva shanim, achlu shana rishona masha bebatim. Year 1, they ate the food at home. Year 2, they eat the food in the field. Year 3, they eat kosher animals. Year 4, they eat non-kosher animals. Year 5, they eat insects. Year 6, they eat their children. Year 7, they're eating their own flesh. Staying in Eretz Yisrael is really not a good idea now. So she has to pick up and leave. Now, again, what exactly we're supposed to do in this situation, given the Eli Melech story, that you're not supposed to leave Eretz Yisrael even in a famine, is hard to know. But she couldn't stay. I don't know if this answers your question, but she really couldn't stay. So, again?
Why tell only her to leave?
So apparently this woman had a connection to Elisha, and like what we saw beforehand is Elisha's very focused on helping individuals. Mm-hmm. But here's the paradox. He's helping individuals and he's allowing everybody else to suffer, no? Mm-hmm. That don't sound too great. But that's what's going on. Elisha sends her away for 7 years, and she comes back and she screams that she doesn't have her house, she doesn't have her field. Now when you think about it, and this point I saw is made in this sefer, the Mikdash Melech, which I stole from the Shul library, he makes the point that one should argue that Elisha has really messed her over big time. Because had she hung around Israel, she would have something. Now, because she listened to the Navi, she comes back after 7 years and she doesn't have anything left. Now, again, you might argue, but she would have died if she stayed. Let's say she wouldn't die. Let's say she would have somehow survived the famine. But now, because she listened to the Navi, she's worse off. So what we see about Elisha is that he seems to come across as being a very compassionate person to the individual, but he's hurting society. He's not helping all of society. And even this individual who he supposedly helped, he hurt. Because now that she was away, she comes back, she doesn't have her field. And she goes to the king, and she's screaming to the king, "Give me my field," no? Now at this time, the king is speaking to Gehazi, and the king is saying, "Tell me all the great stuff that Elisha did." What we have over here is, I would say, a Megillas Esther type miracle. There are certain miracles that, like Kriyas Yamsuf, no? Everything is supernatural. Then there are miracles in terms of coincidence. At the moment that Gehazi is speaking to the king, and the king says, "Oh, Gehazi, you tell me nice stuff about Elisha." Right, that's interesting also, no? Gehazi, who had been pushed away from Elisha's group because he lied and he asked for gifts from Naaman after Naaman is healed. Gehazi's pushed away, but still the king says, "Tell me the good stuff that Elisha did." And Gehazi says that. Apparently Gehazi is a complicated figure, like we spoke about 2 weeks ago, whenever it was. We spoke about how Gehazi doesn't seem to be such a complete rusher. He's a little bit money hungry. Okay, some people are like that. But he doesn't seem to be so terrible. Yes, Chazal say he has no place in Olam Haba. But basically the king tells Gehazi, "Tell me all the good stuff that Elisha did." So what happens? Pasuk Hey. Gehazi tells the king the fact that Elisha revived a dead person. Right when the king is saying, "Tell me the good stuff," so at that moment, like, Vayova, that woman comes in, and Gehazi says, "Oh, there she is! That's the woman that Elisha revived her child." So then the king asks the woman, and she tells him the story also. Then the king appoints a certain officer, Saris Echad Leimar, Hashem es kol ha-shalov, es kol tvuos ha-sadeh, miyom azva es ha-aretz ha-ad ato. Return all the stuff that she had beforehand. Meaning to say, achavei kechlos ha-kol, when the story is done, it is Elisha who gets the woman her stuff back. but in this indirect, backhanded sort of way. Right? All of her field came back. Why? Because at the moment the king is asking about how great Elisha is, she testifies about how great Elisha is. The king says, wow, that's really impressive. Give her all her stuff back. Apparently it's done bizchus Elisha. Good? Now, one thing we see about Gehazi over here, and we asked the question why, way back when, why is Elisha keeping Gehazi around? So, one thing we see is that Gehazi is connected to the royal authorities. Gehazi is living with the king, no? Or he's telling the king all the good stuff about Elisha.
Well, he
has access. Elisha apparently wanted... Like we mentioned that the students of Elisha wanted to move out of the city. Elisha says, I want to stay in the city. Elisha felt that his role of Navi is not just to help individuals. He wants to get in with the king. And Elisha, unlike Eliyahu, who is like the most hated man in the kingdom, Elisha is actually beloved by the wicked kings of Israel. No? That's what's going on in this story. The king is asking Gehazi about Elisha. Gehazi says, yeah, he revived a dead kid, right? And then the king is very impressed by Elisha. And we'll see it's not only the king of Israel who's impressed with Elisha, it's foreign kings who are impressed with Elisha also. Elisha wants to influence, but I would say his influence he's trying to do in a nice, kind sort of way, unlike his Rebbe Eliyahu. So far, so good? Now, by the way, just two minor points. A saris. The king gives a saris. What's a saris? An officer. But literally, a saris is a eunuch, no? A saris is a male who is unable to have children because he was castrated. Yes, that's what it means. It's not the most pleasant... Don't bring this up at Shabbos meals. It's probably not the most pleasant topic like for anyone. It's kind of gross. But that's a saris. The Radak is bothered by the Kasha. How can you have sarisim? Right? I understand in Megillas Esther you have sarisim because they're non-Jews.
Yeah.
And those sarisim, by the way, are in charge of the women... Why you have a saris in charge of the women? Because you don't want any regular man to be in charge because we don't have to finish the sentence. Correct?
Where is saris spelled with a shin, not with a
sar? Sar as an officer is spelled with a shin. The English translation over here is doing us a little disservice. The Radak points out... Oh, did I don't think I gave you that Radak. But the Radak in Pasuk Vav points out that a saris is literally a eunuch who is unable to have children. Right? The Radak, I'll read you the Radak. A saris kimashma'o is shenichrasuv beitzav. The apapi shamaisa has a osir be Yisrael. Hayu lahem lamalchi Yisrael sarisim shayolokim osam min hagoyim haheim. Oh, shall you sarisa machmas choli? By the way, this is classic Radak. The Radak feels an obligation to try to give some halachic explanation of what's going on in Tanakh. No? So he sees the word saris, he says, oh, I know what a saris is. Aye, how can you have a saris? Jews are not allowed to have this. So he says, presumably they captured slaves from foreign nations, and those are the sarisim. Now, the fact is, what the king is doing is he's taking a saris who apparently is an officer who you can trust with a woman. So he appoints.
That's obvious, given his.
So he appoints the saris to take care of this woman and to get her field back. That's the way the Radak learns these psukim.
Wasn't Daniel
here?
That's what I heard.
Daniel?
I don't know
Daniel. In Megillas Esther, you have Sabisim also.
Right. I heard Daniel himself was a eunuch.
I don't know. Okay. I'm not familiar. Tana. Okay. Now, next pasuk. Elisha goes to Damesek. Elisha likes cities. He leaves Shomron and he goes to Damesek, is Damascus. And Ben-Hadad, the king of Aram, is sick. And they tell Ben-Hadad that the Isha Elohim, the man of God, is coming. So the king sends Chazael. Chazael apparently is a trusted servant. And he says, take a gift and go meet Elisha and investigate from God whether or not I will live from this illness. Now this is an unbelievable thing. Ben-Hadad is the king of Aram, not Jewish. Not Jewish and not good. Right? Ben-Hadad is sick. And he wants to find out, am I going to survive? So he says, ask the prophet. Ask the prophet. This, by the way, is exactly the opposite of what we have in Malachim Beis Perek Aleph. If you'll turn to page 4 on these sheets. You have Ahaziah, who is a king of Yisrael, who falls through some lattice, right, in the attic. He gets sick, and he sends messengers to say, go ask the Avodah Zarah im echya mecholizah. Right? He writes, Dear Shu Baal Zavuv Elohei Ekron, ask Baal Zavuv, right, the master, the lord of the flies, ask the master of the fly, right, that's what it means.
Yeah, I get it.
Ask Baal Zavuv, am I going to live? Now, a messenger of Hashem speaks Eliyahu HaNavi and says, you know what? Go to the king and tell him, Hamibli Eino Lahim B'Yisrael Atem Hochim L'Josh B'Baal Zavuv Elohei Ekron. So says God, the bed that you're on, you're not going to come off, you're going to die, etc. What we have over here is the story of a king who's sick. The king wants to know, will I live? King Ahaziyahu asks Avodah Zarah, and Eliyahu comes and says, what? There's no, you don't get your own God. Right? And therefore, so saith the Lord, you will die. Right? You can see Eliyahu is like full of fire, right? That's it. You're going to die. End of conversation. Elisha, because of the type of person he is, so you have a non-Jewish king who's sick, who seeks out the Navi of Hashem, the same exact Lashon in the Pasuk. Ha'echya mecholizeh? Will I survive? Right? That's the question. Now, Chazael goes to meet Elisha, and he takes a gift. V'chol tuv damesek, masa arba'im gamal, pasuk tes, he takes all of the best stuff in Damascus that can be carried on 40 camels. Now, presumably Damascus had more than 40 camels worth of good stuff. But this is like the spitz, right? The really good stuff. And he comes to Elisha and he says, Vayomer bincha ben Hadad melach Aram, your son ben Hadad. This is a tremendous amount of deference to the Navi. And he asks, Shelachani elacha leimah ha'echya mecholizeh. Vayomer elav Elisha. So Elisha says, Leich amar. And now how do you read this? This pasuk is the key to everything, okay? The question is asked, will I live? Right? Chazael brings that question on behalf of Ben-Hadad. So Elisha sends back a message, and the message, there's a kri uktiv. Now, in Chumash, kri uktiv means that one is wrong. The way we read it is the correct one. The other one is a tradition that may be wrong. Some of the Mefarshim even point out that the Kri Uktiv, we keep it in the Sefer Torah, but realistically speaking, the Mesorah, the tradition, is only the way we read it. That's what may Mefarshim have it in Chumash. In Navi, Kri Uktiv often means two different traditions, and we're not sure which one is right. The Radak has this at the beginning of Yehoshua in a few places. The Radak over here also has this. The Radak also has this over here. Basically, the two versions are, one, lo with an aleph, lo chayotichya, that means you will not live. Version 2, in the parentheses, emar lo, tell him chayotichya. Tell him you'll live. But God showed me that you'll die. God showed me that he will die. So now, this pasuk is very hard to understand, but effectively, what Elisha is telling Hazael is, go back to the king and tell the king that you, king, are going to die. But don't say you're going to die. Say instead that you, king, are going to live. But really, you're going to die. That's the double talk. The low with the aleph and the low with the vav means, tell him you'll live. But God showed me that you're going to die.
He's
going
to die.
What?
Well, he's
going to
die.
But everybody's
going to die.
Yeah, but you're going to die now from this illness.
Oh, okay.
Right? The question is, Ben Hadad is asking, will I live or die? Answer, you're going to die, but we'll tell you that you're going to live. Now, why would we do this? If you're going to die, why would we say you'll live?
Diplomacy.
Diplomacy, right? Now, that's, diplomacy is a fancy way in political jargon of saying lying, but politicians lie all the time to accomplish something. That's one approach. Another approach could be, some of the Mefarshim say that...
anybody use the word tact?
Tact. Tact is another, is a nicer way of saying lying. Right? Mm. By the way, lying is not something that we look so positively on in Tanakh. This week's parasha. This week's parasha, right? I have a Yaakov and an Esav, and Vayakveni Zepamayim et Duchorati Lakach, right? Halo Koach Akov Yaakov, right? The Novi Yirmiyahu is critical of Yaakov Avinu for lying. Lying is not a very good thing. The Mitsudos explains, it's the last verse I give you on the sheet. The Mitsudos explains that maybe what's going on over here is it's something that's said to comfort a person. We have a din in Yeriday in Hilchos Avelos, so when someone is very sick, you don't give them bad news, no? I just got a shaila about this somewhat recently. A person who's very ill, do you tell them that their relative died? So you're passing Yeriday that you don't, no? We're right, any bad news could potentially kill a person. Even when you say vidui to a person, at the end of life, you walk over to the person, you say, but you should know this is the hardest thing for me as a rabbi. It's much harder than doing funerals. Funerals are easy. Vidui is hard. To go over to a person and say, you know what? Many people survive this illness, but it could be that you'll die. And just in case you'll die, let's say vidui together. And it says in Shulchan, you're not allowed to say vidui while you're crying. You have to say it with composure. That's very hard. We don't want to scare people. So comes along the Mitsudos, and he says that Elisha is basically saying you're going to die, but we'll say that you'll live because it's the type of lie that's a permitted lie in Shulchan Aruch. Now, by the way, philosophically, there is a school of philosophers who assume that lying is always terrible and always forbidden. Saint Augustine felt that lying is like the worst thing ever. And he was followed by Kant. Kant says, and I quote, "Truthfulness is a duty that must be regarded as the ground of all duties based on contract. To be truthful in all declarations is sacred and absolutely commanding decree of reason, limited by no expediency." According to Kant, you're never allowed to lie. Some of the later philosophers speak about that would mean if someone's living in Nazi Germany, the person would not be allowed to forge documents to try to get out, no? According to Kant, again, this is not the Jewish approach, although I should point out that there's one opinion in Ksubas Daf Yotes, that to sign a document falsely is Yehori Goyavar. But we have a tradition that there are three Averis that you have to give up your life for. No? Gilai Reiser, Avodah Zarah, and Shefichas Damim. Sheker is not one of them. But Ksubas Yotes is one. There's one opinion that to sign a document falsely is Yahari Vayahar also. Kant would take that approach. Even if telling the truth will cause the death of an innocent person, it's forbidden to lie. Tanakh has a much more complicated view of lying. In Tanakh, lying is not the way Kant says it, no? Haraya, Yaakov Avinu lied. Now, it might be something that isn't looked positively on, but the fact that Tanakh says that it was done means, you know what, sometimes you do something bad, then you clap al chet. And Elisha, who's a Navi, is lying. Nevi'im are the mouthpiece of the Almighty. If a Navi is lying, that means that lying is not as bad as many of the philosophers say. Correct? That's point one. Now, what's the pshat in this lie, specifically? Right? Let's just go through the psukim. I want to read four or five more psukim, then we'll come back and we'll flesh out this story more. So Elisha says, tell the king that you'll live, even though God showed me that you'll die. Vayameres panov vayosem ad bosh, vayev kesharokim. But when he presents this information to Hazael, and he says, Hazael, tell the king he's going to die. Tell the king, excuse me, he's going to live, but he will really die. So Elisha has to like hold himself back. Vayameret panav. He holds his face in. Vayasim et bosh. He's like ashamed, and he cries. So Hazael says, why are you crying, Elisha? And Elisha has to spill the beans. He says, because I know what you're going to do to the Jewish people. You'll do terrible things. You're going to destroy their cities. You're going to kill their people. You're going to kill their babies. You're going to rip open harotehem tivakea. That's a very powerful image. You will rip open the pregnant women. Chazael, you're going to do all these terrible things. And that's why I'm crying. Now, Chazael says, what, you think I'm a dog that I'm going to do such bad things? Elisha says, God showed me that you're going to be the king. We'll talk about that pasuk also. So then he leaves Elisha. He goes back to his master, to Ben-Hadad. Ben-Hadad says, what did Elisha say? So Hazael answers, you'll live! The next day, Vayikach HaMachber, Hazael takes a blanket of some sort, he dips it in water, he spreads it on his face, and he kills the king. And he kills Ben-Hadad. Right? So what is going on over here is, right, if I put this into context, not only is Elisha lying, but the Radak says, Elisha is saying to Hazael, tell the king that you're going to live, but he's going to die. He's like whispering to him, he's going to die. Meaning Hazael is reading this as, oh, I should kill him. Okay, got it. I can do. I know how to murder. Right? We learned it in Hazael school over there. We can do murder. And look at the Radak. The Radak writes, on this is the last Radak on page 5, whatever. Right? Her ani Hashem ki mos yomos kiloma min hachole yechyeh. He's going to live from the illness. Right? Im lo yumat. He'll live if he's not killed. But God said that you're going to kill him. Therefore, when Elisha says it to Hazael, that he's going to be the king, and he says, oh, God said he's going to die, that the king will die. So Hazael understood that what that means is that he should kill him. Then Hazael goes, he takes the blanket, puts him on his face, suffocates him, kills him, end of Ben-Hadad. Now, doesn't this reflect poorly on Elisha? He basically orchestrated an assassination. An assassination of a king who genuinely respected Elisha. Right? It's not like Ben-Hadad is this king who is... Yes, Aram was a nuisance to Klal Yisrael. They had been in wars and stuff. But at this point, Ben-Hadad really respects Elisha. And Elisha basically kills him. No? Not too good. It does not reflect well on Elisha. I have over here an article called Lies by Prophets and Other Lies in the Hebrew Bible by Yael Shemesh of Bar Ilan. It's found in the Jewish the Journal of Ancient Near Eastern Studies, Volume 29. I had to figure out what J-A-N-E-S stood for. It's the Journal of Ancient Near Eastern Studies, Volume 29. She basically says that this is one of the paradigmatic cases in Tanakh where there's a really bad lie going on, but the Tanakh is kind of hiding it. That low versus low, right? Will he not live or will he live? Right? This, we're trying to hide what the Navi is doing because we don't want the Navi to come out as being so bad. That's her approach. I don't know. It's what to think about. I'm not sure. But let's just go on. Yes?
If he's saying it to him, isn't that sort of like a homophonic thing? Like he's saying it ambiguously enough so that it's...
Yeah, absolutely.
Well,
and we don't
know. I get it's not part of what he's saying.
And again, I don't know what language they were speaking. Mm-hmm. And, right, Tanakh is written in Hebrew, but I don't know. But, fair point. Now, why exactly did Elisha go to Damascus? Right? Pasuk Zion begins. Elisha goes into Damascus. Ben-Hadad is sick. Apparently, Elisha never really made it into Damascus. Right? He never really made it into the city when Hazael comes to him with the gift. Why is he going to Damascus? So, Rashi learns, and one Perush in the Radak is, I give you the Radak on page 5 or whatever, that he's going because Gehazi is in Damascus, and Elisha is going to Damascus in order to bring Gehazi back. Elisha, who cares about the individual so much, is going to Damascus because his former student, Gehazi, is there, and I want to bring him back into the fold. That's what the...
Wasn't he just talking to the king of Israel?
What?
Wasn't Gehazi just talking to the king?
Gehazi apparently was just talking to the king of Israel beforehand. But apparently now Gehazi had gone to Damascus afterwards. That's the way they learn. It is a... Yeah. It's not clear. Not clear exactly how he got to Damascus. That's a very good point. According to Rashi and Radak, that's what's going on. Now, the Radak, though, has a second explanation. Or, actually, in our Radak, it's the first explanation. And the first explanation says that Elisha is going to Damascus precisely to anoint Hazael as king. Hazael, who is this messenger who comes with the gift for Elisha, and then Elisha says, by the way, whisper, kill Ben-Hadad, right? That Hazael is supposed to be anointed as king. How do you know that? And so we know this from Psukim in Malachim 1, chapter 19. You see, Eliyahu HaNavi felt that Ahav is a really bad guy, no? In fact, Ahav really is really bad. Right? Eliyahu says that I can't handle this Ahav. He's just terrible. Klal Yisrael is like giving up on all of your mitzvos. They're destroying them as bayachs. They're killing the Nevi'im. I'm the only one who's fighting for Hashem. And they're trying to kill me. Eliyahu says, it's awful. It's a terrible situation. So God, right, it sounds like Eliyahu wants to give up. And God turns to Eliyahu and he says, go back to Damascus. And you'll go there and you will anoint Hazael as king over Aram. And then you will appoint Yehu ben Nimshi as the king over Yisrael. And you will appoint Elisha as the Navi. V'haya, hanimrat mecherv Hazael, yamit Yehu. Hanimrat mecherv Yehu, yamit Elisha. What God is telling Eliyahu is, Eliyahu, don't despair. Ahab is terrible, but Ahab and his family, their end is in sight. Because there are three people in order who will go and destroy Ahab. They are Hazael, followed by Yehu, followed by Elisha, right? Meaning that these people will destroy the house of Ahab, the house that Eliyahu is complaining about so much. Eliyahu never carries out points 1 and 2 of his mission. He appointed Elisha as his successor as Navi. But he never appointed Hazael as king over Aram. He never appointed Yehu as king over Yisrael, the Yehu who's going to end up finally killing all of Ahab's family. Eliyahu never did those jobs. Elisha, by the way, has been a Navi now for 66 years. It's a long time. Elisha realizes that my career is nearing the end and I have to finish my Rebbe's job. Meaning, I have to appoint Hazael. So he picks up, says the Radak, and he goes to Damascus to anoint Hazael as king. That's what Elisha's trying to do. And now you can understand why Elisha is kind of being so backhanded, sly, lying, because he has a prophecy to carry out. That prophecy is, anoint Hazael as king. So when Hazael comes to Elisha with the gift, Elisha says, okay, now's my opportunity. You're going to be the king. You know what? Kill the king! Kill Ben-Hadad. Why? Because there is a promise from Hashem that you're going to do this. But how does Elisha react? Elisha's not happy about this. He's crying. No? Elisha's crying. And Hazael says, why are you crying? Elisha apparently, and this is the way Rav Samet, Rav Hanan Samet, in his Sefer Pirkei Elisha takes it. Elisha, as understood by Eliyahu, there in Perek Yutes of Melachim Aleph, is supposed to be the murderous one who finally knocks off, who's the Makkeh B'Patish, who's the final blow to Ahab's family. But Elisha takes a different path. He's not harsh. He's not tough. Elisha is soft. He wants people to like him. He helps individuals, right? He's Me'uravim Habrios. He's taking a different approach. But he realizes that, you know what, I have to appoint Hazael. He's the king. And it really bothers me. It bothers me that Klal Yisrael is going to end up being destroyed by this man, of course. But it also bothers me, and tears reflect a certain ambivalence, no? The Gemara in Bava Basra writes that Moshe Rabbeinu wrote the last psukim in the Torah when he's crying. Right? It's not just because he's talking about Yom HaShem Moshe, and Moshe's going to die, and he's like, oh, Nebuch, I'm going to die. Moshe Rabbeinu knew he's going to die. It's not because he's sad. It's because there's a certain ambivalence that Moshe Rabbeinu is saying, you know what, these psukim, maybe they don't have the full Kedushas HaTorah because Yehoshua, etc., the way the Rav explained it. But the fact is, Hazael is going to be the next king over Aram. Hazael is going to destroy the Jewish people. But Elisha says, I have to do this. I have to appoint him as king. And because I have to appoint him as king, I'm crying when I do it. Crying not only because Klal Yisrael is going to suffer, but crying because this is not the mission I imagined for myself. That's the way Elchanan Samet takes it. That Elisha imagined for himself a mission very different. He imagined for himself a mission that he would really help people, etc., and that's not the way the cookie crumbled. Now, we'll see Elisha's involvement in the appointing of Yehu later on. There's no real miracles here. The last miracles of Elisha are miracles of coincidence, no? He's going towards Damascus. Maybe he's even going towards Damascus for a different reason, to bring Gehazi back, to be the same compassionate Elisha who never gives up on people. But ultimately he meets Hazael. He says, okay, Hazael is here. I have to carry out that mission. That's the way Elchanan Samet takes it. I'm not sure if any of this is accurate, but I think it's an interesting read, certainly, on these psukim. I don't know if it's worth now, time is like going through the last couple of psukim in the parak in terms of who becomes the next king of Yehuda, next king of Yisrael, etc. It's nothing of such substance, but effectively what we're trying to focus on are the tears of Elisha. Those tears are very significant because those tears represent Elisha knowing what's going to happen to Klal Yisrael, one. Two, Elisha knowing what happened to his attempt Elisha, when all is said and done, ends up being much more similar to Eliyahu, because he's the vehicle that people suffer to bring them closer to Hashem. You need a Hazael to destroy Ahab. You need a Yael to destroy Ahab to bring people closer to Hashem. That's sort of Eliyahu's approach. You bring famine, right? People have to suffer to bring them closer to Hashem. Elisha's approach to use honey was not effective, and that's sort of why he's crying, according to this explanation. So thank you for coming. Thank you for listening. Have a good night.